You're with Misty Winston on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello and happy Monday. Welcome to the Misty Winston Show on TNT Radio. Okay, so before we jump to our next guest, I have another Assange update. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of Assange updates because there's a lot happening right now. We're in kind of crunch time. There's a lot of moving parts floating around. So first of all, tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern, Consortium News is doing a panel discussion with doctors for Assange. So please tune in for that. They always do amazing. I say it all the time. If you cover Julian Assange, in my opinion, it's never enough, except for Consortium News. They do an unbelievable job of making sure that they cover every aspect of this case. So shout out to them for all of their amazing work. They also have an article out from yesterday, June 12th, Doctor's Order, Do Not Extradite Assange. So from the article, ahead of the UK Home Secretary's decision on whether to extradite Julian Assange to the United States, a group of more than 300 doctors representing 35 countries have told Priti Patel that approving his extradition would be, quote, medically and ethically unacceptable, end quote. In an open letter sent to the Home Secretary on Friday, June 10th, and copied to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Justice Robert Buckland, the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, and the Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong, the doctors draw attention to the fact that Assange suffered a mini stroke in October of 2021. They note, quote, predictably, Mr. Assange's health has since continued to deteriorate in your custody. In October 2021, Mr. Assange suffered a mini stroke. This dramatic deterioration of Mr. Assange's health has not yet been considered in his extradition proceedings. The U.S. assurances accepted by the High Court, therefore, which would form the basis of any extradition approval, are founded upon outdated medical information, rendering them obsolete. So just a brief aside on that aspect of it. So the United States, after losing the extradition in January 4th, 2020, Judge Vanessa Baratza ruled against extradition based on Julian Assange's mental health. Obviously, the United States appealed that decision. And in that appeal, they offered, quote unquote, assurances. And basically, it's they're not worth the paper that they're written on. Obvious. I mean, it's from the United States. Anybody that trusts the United States on their word is a fool. But there's also, they're very vague. It gives them a backdoor to go back on these things that they're claiming. They're saying that they'll, we promise we're going to be nice. We're not going to put them in a maximum security prison. And we won't put them under special administrative measures, you know, all of that good stuff, in an attempt to kind of convince the court that Julian Assange's mental health wouldn't be made worse by the conditions that he would be held in the United States. Obviously, that's ridiculous. They will absolutely be horrible to him. I think everybody knows that. As I said, the assurances are very vaguely written, and it leaves like a backdoor where if Julian says or does anything that they deem to be a threat to national security, and they get to just make that up however they, whatever they say, they get to decide what that means, then they can go back on those and put him in any conditions that they deem fit. So that's what they're talking about. These assurances were made prior to the mini stroke that Julian Assange suffered October 29th of 2021. That was actually during the hearings that were taking place, the appeal hearings. And in that moment where Julian Assange is sitting, he's been unable to attend his own court hearings in person, despite applying for that privilege to do so. They are not allowing him to appear in person. So he was appearing via video link, basically just watching. He wasn't able to participate in the hearings, but he was watching it. And there's actually a photo that was leaked of him, and he looks, I mean, I'm sorry, Julian. He looked terrible. I mean, he looked very pale, very gaunt, very thin, very weak. During that hearing, the prosecution was trying to claim that Julian Assange is a malingerer, that he's faking his health issues so that he can avoid extradition, all of that stuff. And it turns out in that very moment, he was having a mini stroke. It's mind blowing to me to think of him being in that situation and listening to these people talk about him faking his health issues to avoid extradition as he's having a mini stroke. It's kind of unreal. That has not been addressed in the court so far, the fact that he has had a mini stroke. And certainly I would hope that that would, bear heavy on the decision. I would hope. But we all know that that's not what happens in the real world. Okay. So In this consortium news article, the doctors also charged that any extradition under these circumstances would constitute negligence. They write, quote, under conditions in which the UK legal system has failed to take Mr. Assange's current health status into account, no valid decision regarding his extradition may be made by yourself or anyone else. Should he come to harm in the US under these circumstances, it is you, Home Secretary, who will be left holding the responsibility for that negligent outcome. In their letter, the group reminds the Home Secretary that they first wrote to her on Friday, the 22nd of November of 2019, expressing their serious concerns about Julian Assange's deteriorating health. Those concerns were subsequently borne out by the testimony of expert witnesses in court during Assange's extradition proceedings, which led to the denial of his extradition by the original judge on health grounds. That's what I just explained. That decision was later overturned by a higher court, which referred the decision to Priti Patel in light of U.S. assurances that Julian Assange would not be treated inhumanely. The doctors write, quote, the subsequent assurances of the United States government that Mr. Assange would not be treated inhumanely are worthless given their record of pursuit, persecution, and plotted murder of Mr. Assange and retaliation for his public interest journalism. And then they conclude, quote, Home Secretary, in making your decision as to extradition, do not make yourself, your government, and your country complicit in the slow motion execution of this award-winning journalist, arguably the foremost publisher of our time. Do not extradite Julian Assange, free him, end quote. So obviously Julian remains in a high security prison, Belmarsh prison, awaiting the decision, which is due any day. The statutory deadline is June 19th. I think that that falls on a weekend. So I think people are saying June 17th would be potentially the day. But Priti Patel can also call for an extension on that, which I think is pretty likely. They like to drag this stuff out for as long as possible. But there's some momentum shifting. We're having a lot of things kind of swing around in our favor here. Not to say that it's going to do any good, because let's not be unclear here. This is a very corrupt process. And so it has been corrupt the entire way through. This case should have never been brought. So we still have to maintain vigilance. We still have to keep the pressure up. Contact Anthony Albanese, contact Priti Patel, the Department of Justice, the White House, your own representatives, your own MPs. We need mass public pressure in order to, save the life of Julian Assange, who has done more to expose the war crimes and corruption of empire than anyone on planet Earth. I think it's fair to say. So keep the pressure up for sure. And hopefully we'll have, some good news pretty soon. Julian Assange's 51st birthday is the 3rd of July. So this will be his fourth birthday spent in Belmarsh prison. And it would be really cool to just be able to send him home. That would be a nice birthday present, I think. So that's what I have for you for today. This is TNT Radio.
Gaining perspectives.
It's well-balanced conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, joining us now is Dr. Piers Robinson. Dr. Robinson is a political scientist who is currently serving as co-director of the Organization for Propaganda Studies. He's also editor of the new organization Propaganda and Focus. He's a member of PANDA, convener of the working group on Syria, Propaganda and Media, an associated researcher with the Working Group on Propaganda and the 9/11 Global War on Terror. Today, we're going to be discussing probably the Paul Mason stuff that's going on, because I think this directly impacts Dr. Robinson. But we're also going to talk about Propaganda and Focus, which is a new organization that provides a forum for expert opinion and analysis about propaganda and its consequences, facilitating debate over more democratic and progressive forms of organized persuasive communication and censored scholarship. Hello, Dr. Robinson. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, good evening. Well, good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
Yes, it's good to have you as always. Okay, so let's talk about Paul Mason a little bit before we jump into the new Propaganda and Focus, because this obviously impacts you. I know that you've been tweeting about it. We've covered it a bit on this show and not in depth. Kit Clarenberg's going to be on later this week to really cover it in depth. But obviously this impacts you, and I think that it really just kind of provides, I've been talking about this for a long time, that the anti-war, anti-establishment left is under attack. People looked at me like I was crazy. And I think this is really starting to play itself out here. So tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same kind of patterns of censorship and suppression that we saw with your excellent overview of the situation with Julian Assange. We're just a small bit part experiencing the kind of the weight that the state is applying to people trying to speak out or even to sort of have open debate on things such as foreign policy. And what this Paul Mason story has sort of come out exploded in the last week or so. And this was Kit Clarenberg and Max Blumenthal's reporting for Grey Zone, was Paul Mason. He's this UK-based journalist. I use that term advisedly. Yes. Who is seen to be on the political left, but has developed a reputation in recent years for being sort of what people describe as the kind of sort of fake left and so on. Anyway, it transpired through leaked emails, I believe, emails and communications that he was plotting with a security type contractor, and also now it transpires in communication with elements of the UK government in order to target the Grey Zone, independent media outlet, of course, with Max and Aramate and others. But also, and this is why I come into it, also apparently with having a go at the rogue professors, hard left professors, which of course I've been involved with for about since 2018, where a group of us who have been looking at the war in Syria, and then particularly been involved in reporting on the OPCW chemical weapons scandal, have been subjected to dizzying levels of attacks and smears from corporate media. And here's Paul Mason sort of preparing, and apparently he was involved in the BBC report on File 4, which really gunned for Tim Haywood, a colleague of mine, and also other academics, Justin Schlossberg in the UK, all running with this idea that you've got these academics and professors who are sort of peddling Russian disinformation, and we have to do something about them. We have to shut them up. What we can't do is to have a rational discussion with issues right. in relation to foreign policy. We have to shut them up. And so this is what's transpired. And as I said, it's transpired that Paul Mason has been, there's been a relationship with the UK government. There's also been a relationship with academics as well, which I'm not going to say too much about because there's more coming out on that, and it's a bit depressing for me because somebody involved is somebody who I know and have worked with in the past, who appears to have been involved in activities related to what Paul Mason was doing. But it's just what you're experiencing over on your side of the Atlantic. It's just this incredibly crude, unsophisticated line that anybody who's questioning foreign policy must be working with the Russians or must be sort of basically pushing Russian propaganda. And now we're into this territory where they're just using all means available to try and shut people down. And I saw earlier today that a Grey Zone discussion between Aaron Maté and Max Blumenthal about this, about the Paul Mason issue, had been pulled off YouTube on grounds that there's some bullying and harassment involved. Yeah, Paul Mason plotting to close down the Grey Zone and target the rogue professors, and they just turn the table and turn around and say, well, these people are bullying and harassing us. It's incredible. It really is. Yes. Beyond the pale. But it's a sign of the times, and of course Julian Assange represents the pinnacle of this at the moment. And is a symbol for the state, as we said before, and together in interviews, a symbol of how far the state is willing to go to shut people up. But we're well down the road into this Orwellian nightmare of censorship and bullying and so on. So that's where we are. I mean, Paul Mason's not doing too well at the moment because I think that there's been quite a groundswell of reaction to what he seems to have been involved in, the idea that he's been sort of drawing, apparently, allegedly, as lawyers are getting involved, as far as I'm aware, allegedly drawing maps of the sort of the networks on the left and so on. He's caused a lot of upset, and I understand on Sunday he didn't succeed in getting shortlisted for becoming a Labour MP. So he's not doing too well on the PR front with this, and he's looking very compromised. But there's more to come out with this, and unfortunately some of it does come sort of link into me and my colleagues, professors, who I've worked with on Syria, because it seems to be the case that we've been yet again you know, sort of forces aligning to just attack us again, and working with the BBC again, all the usual suspects in a way. Yeah, and so there you go. That's the modern world for you.
I know. Every time I think I can't be surprised anymore, I find myself being surprised, because it really is just getting so blatant and so, I mean, really just intense. And I think that it's worth mentioning that this isn't now it's moved from just, you know, censorship and soft censorship to now financial aspects of things. They're now starting to have people take, I mean, we saw Mint Press News and Consortium News get hit by PayPal. Yeah. Alan McLeod has been hit by PayPal recently, Jackson Hinkle was hit by PayPal and Venmo. And I've been warning people that that's the thing that's going to start happening. They're going to start coming after independent media economically. I really liken it to economic sanctions on independent media. That's how they're trying to force people out. People who don't follow the narrative. Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely brutal. I mean, yes. As we know, and as you know, that they've been doing this quite a bit for a number of years now. They've been going in for, I think I could be wrong here, but I think sort of people such as, I think, Vanessa Beely and maybe Eva Bartlett had problems with Patreon, and or at least there were indications of that. This has been going on for a while, this targeting people's financial flows. And of course, this is a huge deal for independent media. But in a way, this is what they're also doing with the academics and my colleagues who are sort of still in institutions, is that they're trying to get them out of their jobs.
Yes.
That's what they're trying to do. So they're trying to basically de-incentivize people to ask these kind of questions. We seem to have gone, the levels are now off the charts. I mean, we've seen it with COVID-19 censorship. We saw it, obviously, we discussed this before in relation to the science and the scientists who are questioning things such as lockdown, and they were being censored. It was occurring before that, obviously, but now the Ukraine conflict, it now just seems to really ratcheted up a gear, and they're taking demonetizing left, right, and center.
Yes.
I caught out of the corner of my eye that Canadian study, and study in inverted commas, which was just listing sort of Canadian mouthpieces for Putin and the Russians, etc. And I mean, I think Aaron Maté was in there. I think Tulsi Gabbard was in there. And I think Denny Rancor. It was incredible. And just basing, based on the logic that because these people say things which, don't align with Western governments, they must therefore be influenced by Russia. That they, it's decided they couldn't arrive at these positions without being influenced by Putin and the Russians. And it's McCarthy, right? It's listing people. It's listing people. And this will have immediate and real life consequences. If you're a young academic at university, for example, and your name appears on one of those lists, these things start to do damage. So they're out of control. They're hitting everybody, and they're hitting the independent journalists, and they're hitting academics. And, you would have thought at some point, the more they do this, the more that they discredit themselves and they discredit the system. Yeah. I think, this kind of heavy-handed censorship, you ultimately gets to a point where you just lose the support and the belief of so much of the population, because they can see what you're doing, right? They can see that people are being closed down, being deplatformed. And anyone who for a second just thinks, well, what does this really mean? What it really means is that they know that the arguments that they have to support their policies, whether it's conflicts and so on, or in any other areas, they simply don't have good, solid grounds. They can't argue rationally. So they can't argue rationally. People won't believe them. So that their only recourse is to just shut people down and to stop free speech and free and open debate. But in doing that, they just further damage their own credibility in the eyes of more and more people. And it will come to a crunch point at some point. although, you know, we're caught in these rapidly evolving circumstances, aren't we, at the moment, with whether it's war or whether it's the economic situation. You know, the COVID narrative is, I mean, I can't be sure, but I don't think there are any signs that it's really gone away. It's going to be kicked back in. We've got a hell of a lot going on and a hell of a lot of potential to distract. But yeah, in all of that, I think the heavy-handed censorship just, you know, it's a diminishing returns for authorities.
I agree. Absolutely. And Julian, there's a quote from Julian Assange that I always lean on when I'm feeling a little bit stressed out by the censorship. He says, censorship is always cause for celebration. It is always an opportunity because it reveals fear of reform. It means that the power position is so weak that you've got to care what people think. And he's absolutely right. They aren't. I think that's why they're so desperately trying to silence any and all dialogue, conversation, questioning, dissent, because they know that their position is weak and they know that they're struggling to maintain control of the narrative. And so this heavy-handedness, I think, is really just desperation. Okay, so we have to take a quick break, but everybody hang tight. We're going to be right back with more from Piers Robinson right after this here on TNT Radio.
God, you're amazing. You're a much better listener than my wife. You're always there for me. I think I may be in love.
Where is she?
Well, it's not what it seems. I was talking to...
Who's the tramp I heard you talking to?
That was my Alexa, sweetie.
Well, she sounds like a tramp.
Fall in love with news and talk all over again with your smart device. Just tell it to play.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A lot of people may not agree with us right now, but there may come a time when they actually have an issue that affects them, that they don't have the freedom to choose. And if we don't preserve it, we won't have it.
You have to see this for yourself.
We begin this new week with an extraordinary moment in our history. 18 days into this truck convoy, and the federal government invoked a security measure that goes beyond anything seen in this country in the last 50 years.
Banks will be told to freeze the accounts of anyone helping finance the protests. And the owners of vehicles jamming streets will be directly targeted.
Trucking for Freedom, Chapter 1, How We Got Here. Visit truckingforfreedom.com.
It's not just a music box. It's a ballerina's castle. It's a place to keep special things. It's noticing the letter. It's hearing it's for her mom. It's the moment you realize a 10-year-old girl has come to terms with her terminal illness. It's telling her how brave she is. It's agreeing to pass the letter on after she's gone. It's not just a music box. It's one of the most important tools we use. Social work with children and families is changing. Join us. Call 0300 123 1220 or search Be The Difference.
Mask mandates don't work.
No.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Let's do it.
Today's News Talk Radio.
TNT.
Hello, we are talking to Dr. Piers Robinson. We were talking there briefly about it's kind of an intense escalation of propaganda and censorship combined. It's kind of an unprecedented level of censorship that we're dealing with. And that's coming for people like Dr. Robinson, who are leftist academics, and as in addition to independent media. We talked a bit about the financial attacks through PayPal, Venmo, you know, GoFundMe, all of that stuff. I would just like to point out that that's one of the first ways that they went after Julian Assange. So this is a method that they have tested. They have figured out how it works. And that is, I mean, they shut WikiLeaks down from every essential financial aspect of PayPal, even the credit card companies, all of those things shut them out, which, I mean, really forced them to go into cryptocurrency very early on. But that is exactly the kind of, you know, the methodology that they use. They are always going to use economic sanctions. And really, that's what it is on independent media. And I also mentioned, too, that Kit Clarenberg is going to be on the show to discuss this more in depth. That's going to be Thursday at 5, if anybody wants to tune in, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern. Kit Clarenberg, who co-authored the article that we were just discussing with Max Blumenthal about Paul Mason and his very weird and desperate attempts to, you know, attack people who speak outside the lines, who, you know, offer a different narrative than the Western approved narrative. So Kit Clarenberg will be on the show Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern. And he has told me that there will potentially be some updates and some new information coming out. So definitely tune in for that. Okay, Dr. Robinson, I want to talk to you about Propaganda and Focus. This is a new organization that you are the editor of. So tell tell us a little bit about this and what the goal is here.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much an organization as an online web zine or journal. And the idea here is that I've been involved for a number of years with quite a wide range of academics working on areas such as Syria, 9/11, global war on terror, and also more recently in COVID. And one of the things that we've become very aware of is the difficulty for mainstream academics to actually write in a way which is genuine and which is objective, because there are so many pressures and constraints within academia. It's the same kind of constraints that you see in the mainstream media. That we've known for a long time that there's a real demand and need for a platform whereby academics can start to write in a more open and a more engaging fashion to actually engage the public on these key issues in relation to propaganda. So this is where the idea came from, was to sort of really provide a platform for academics who are having difficulty, you know, battling against the kind of self-censorship and internal censorship that you see within academia. But that's part of the idea. The second part of the idea was that we also, as academics and as researchers, we need to start engaging with the public. That academics, you know, traditionally have been very sort of reluctant to really play the role of public intellectuals, partly because, you know, universities are timid about this now. You know, you speak out on issues and universities are scared of negative publicity and so on. But this idea that we should be, you know, trying to get information out into the public domain on matters of import and so on. And so that's where the idea for this came from. And a colleague, Dan Brody, is a professor in Japan, and Ben Lindsley, who's a man who I've worked with for a number of years, pulled together with a little work from Ben, pulled together the magazine and have launched it. It's, you know, at the moment we're intending to combine both relatively short commentary style pieces on current events, but also importantly, we're trying to develop longer pieces where sort of experts and academics have time to, for example, take members of the public through some of the theories and some of the kind of history surrounding propaganda and so on, or earlier cases of major events which have been propagandized. So it's meant to have an educational kind of role. And we'll see how it develops. We'll see what kind of focus the various articles have. But I think that's a good mix to have. It's a good mix to have the possibility for commentary on current events, which is what we have in a lot of the articles. But then to also have these more in-depth investigations, but also sort of in-depth pieces which talk, as I said, sort of about more historical issues and so on. And in the fullness of time, if it continues to do well and we continue to have people coming to write, you know, we have plans for a section on censored scholarship, because there's a good deal of censored scholarship which has been removed and so on because of propaganda and censorship. And we're also in long term, we might just actually establish a full academic journal arm of Propaganda in Focus, which has full peer review. But that's for later on. At the moment, we're staying with publicly or accessible articles of varying lengths, written by both propaganda experts, but also written by people, researchers and analysts, who want to highlight issues which have been buried because of propaganda. So it's not just about looking at propaganda and the mechanisms of propaganda. It's also about trying to sort of give an airing to issues which have just been completely pushed off people's radar screens because of propaganda. So, you know, we're doing a couple of things in there with what we have at the moment.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. Because there is a lot that, because of propaganda, because of the narrative management, because there is an agenda that they're pushing, there are so many stories that get completely left behind and just not talked about at all because it doesn't fit the current narrative. So I think that that's a, you know, kind of an unspoken victim of propaganda, is those stories that do not get any coverage because they don't fit into the current, you know, kind of rhetoric and agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the, you know, the biggest parts of propaganda is utter silence, is what you don't get to hear about. And of course, this is where the smearing and the suppression comes in. And you know, and there's a real need for that, because one of the things that you find certainly within mainstream academia is that mainstream academics, actually a lot of them actually sort of fall into these very propagandized worldviews, and actually remarkably know far less about what's going on than that they often like to suggest. And so, you know, with propaganda and focus, the idea is that, you know, there are big issues out there. And, you know, we've got a piece, for example, we've got a piece by Elizabeth Woodward and David Ray Griffin summarizing their analysis regarding 9/11. Which came out of the Toronto hearings. You know, that's a major issue, the questions surrounding 9/11 and the global war on terror, which is just absolutely sort of underserved by mainstream academia. And we want to make sure that those issues get covered. The other big issues which have been buried over the last 40, 50 years, the assassinations in the 60s and so on, all of these areas which have been just too difficult for even a lot of independent and alternative media to engage with. We want to make sure that we are, you know, allowing as full and open debate as possible on those issues, as well as covering, you know, the conflict in the Ukraine, you know, and, you know, current events such as Julian Assange. We've got a piece by Catherine Gunn, the GCHQ yes. whistleblower on Julian Assange situation. But, you know, we will try to be as bold as we can be in that sense, and with this recognition that there are big black holes in our public sphere in terms of what is spoken about, and so on. And we need to end that, right? We need to end the silences surrounding 9/11 global war on terror. We need to end the silences surrounding assassinations in the 60s, and of course we're talking about the Kennedys there, but, you know, King as well, and Malcolm X, and others. You know, you have, you know, these bit large scale propaganda campaigns which need to be interrogated and which people are very averse to. And of course, you have this with COVID-19, because this is the big issue of COVID-19, as you know, and I've been involved with Panda, and also written about this more recently, is this trying to sort of piece together the big picture in relation to COVID-19, that what we've been seeing has not been primarily a public health response, that there are political and economic agendas, and a huge amount of propaganda which has sort of distracted people away from these kind of big drives that we've been seeing for the last 2 years. You know, we're trying to make sure that we cover these issues, and we're hoping that by doing that, we'll facilitate wider debate and awareness of these key issues. And I guess, in a way, counter these massive propaganda campaigns that people are subjected to. I suppose in terms of some of the details, we are breaking down at the moment into, you know, we have sections on health, corporate media, war and conflict, technocracy, academia, society. So we're trying to explore, you know, a range of different areas in which propaganda operates and which are highly relevant to what we're seeing in the contemporary world. So that's it in a nutshell. We've got some great people who've joined in. We've got Mark Crispin Miller, who's arguably leading global expert on propaganda. I have huge respect for him. He works alongside me in the Organization for Propaganda Studies, but he's delivered the lead piece. We've got Oliver Boyd Barrett, who's got several papers now, mainly looking at war propaganda in Ukraine. A colleague of mine, Tim Hayward, talking about propaganda within academia, which is very relevant to what we're seeing at the moment in relation to the Paul Mason issue, which Kit will talk more about on Thursday. And we've got a great piece by a younger scholar, Richard Ella Fritz, looking at conspiracy theory and the way that's used. And that's, he's going to do a whole series of pieces on that. He did his doctoral work on the use of the term conspiracy theory to shut debate down. And so he's got a very good in-depth piece. Dan Brody has done a great piece on technocracy So we've got a wide range there, and we will, you know, we've got a steady stream of material which we're putting out, and we'll see how long we survive the census. I mean, the good thing is we're not in it to make money, which is why I'm sure people like me are particularly hated by the authorities, because they're sitting there thinking, how do we de-incentivize this person who's not doing it for money? So, you know, but of course, you know, the censors can come and get you at some point, I guess, you know, on other grounds. Yes. But, you know, but let's just see how it goes. I mean, you push it out there and, you know, we'll see if the censors come.
Well, I think that, as you mentioned earlier, when the Paul Mason stuff broke in the Gray Zone, again, written by Kit Clarenberg and Max Blumenthal, there was, as you mentioned, there was like an immediate reaction to that. And I think that what we're seeing, I think a lot of people are starting to recognize the level of propaganda in this country and the level of censorship. I think that they're seeing the censorship take off. I think, honestly, when a sitting president was removed from the internet, I think that a lot of people kind of snapped out of it, because that was really significant. That was a really significant movement or moment in censorship. The idea that a sitting president could be removed from the entirety of the internet. I mean, even Pinterest went so far as to, that's really significant. And I think that a lot of people were like, oh, okay, wait a minute, this is legit. And that's, we need, places like Propaganda and Focus. I think that it's so crucial because a lot of people don't realize what propaganda is, how it's used, the significance of it, the way that it's able to be utilized in different situations. And I think that really just educating people about that and how they can, recognize propaganda, how they can kind of, realize what's happening around them, seeing the ways that it's used. And like you said, not just in what's what you're hearing, but also what you're not hearing, the things that you're not being told. And I think that that's really crucial. And that's, this Propaganda and Focus, I think it seems like this is going to be a great hub for that, like a real education on propaganda. I mean, again, you have some of the best minds that is around this. And so, I hope the censors don't get to you too soon. You know what I mean? They're going to come for you, I think. But yes.
There's a huge amount of work to be done. And as you say, sort of, you know, take people through, techniques for coping with propaganda, fighting against it and so on. These are all areas which, you know, people need to be educated about and which need to be written about. And also the other thing is, although, you know, we've got a lot of academics working in this, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yes, you can. I had a suspicion for a moment. There was a freeze somewhere in there. But we're also very keen to bring in people who are experts, but not necessarily academics. So, and I think we might even approach you at some point. But we really wanted to approach a number of independent journalists and get them to write for us in terms of their experience of battling propaganda in their role as independent journalists. So we want to be sort of quite open and eclectic in terms of, you know, this is not just about sort of credentialed academics writing about propaganda or issues which have been buried. We're very cognizant of the fact that, you know, as I'm sure you'd be one of the first to tell me, a lot of the best work being done out there are by independent researchers, independent investigative journalists, the usual names. I won't keep on naming them because otherwise people, I'm sucking up to them kind of thing. But, you know, there's great people out there. They're normally well ahead of the curve of the academics. And so, you know, this is something which we will bring into Propaganda and Focus in a pretty even-handed, balanced way. I think, you know, academics do have some skills and ability and to bring to the table, but, you know, it needs to be complemented by people who've operated outside of power structures. The people we're not so keen on writing for us is, and I'm going to be really careful here, but I think Mark's going to do a paper, Mark Chris Mill will do a paper on this fairly soon for us. But, you know, the way in which propaganda has been studied in the academy, has tended to a very large extent to take a what's called kind of problem-solving approach to looking at it. And often when you do talk about propaganda in the academy, you're just talking about Russian propaganda or, you know, Nazi propaganda, etc., and not looking at propaganda within Western governments, within yes. Western countries, for example. We're not really so interested in that kind of sort of gatekeeping academic work which has gone on. And we're certainly, the people who are attacking us at the moment over with the disinformation label and attacking people such as, you know, the Independents as well, we're not interested in that kind of profoundly flawed analysis. So we won't be including so much of that in propaganda and focus. So one would describe it has a critical edge to it, but I'd say it's more, it just has an objective edge to it. And yes. We're not interested in people who've got themselves sucked into the contrails of Western propaganda, for example, which happens to more academics than it should.
Yes, and that's so true. And it's so depressing. It also happens in, has happened in the mainstream press. And I think it's really just because there's a culture of fear that's been created where people are just afraid to speak out, because if you do, then you're targeted, you're labeled a conspiracy theorist. As you just mentioned, there's going to be a paper coming out about that. You're labeled as a, you know, crazy cuckoo brains conspiracy theorist, or you're a Russian asset or whatever. So I think that's really created an environment of fear, and people are just afraid to speak out at this point, which is really unfortunate. We do have to take another quick break, but hang tight. We're going to be right back with more right after this here on TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
During this midterm election year, the establishment's legacy media has continued to froth at the mouth over so-called election-denying conspiracy theorists. And the Republican primary for Nevada Secretary of State, scheduled for the 14th of June, has only escalated legacy media whining. The New York Times is irate over candidate Jim Marchant, as is AP, the Associated Press, which ran an article headlined, "Conspiracies Dominate GOP Primary for Nevada Elections Post." Of the seven candidates for Nevada Secretary of State, Marchant is the most prominent in campaigning for election integrity. But the AP article also refers to candidates Socorro Keenan, Richard Scotty, and Jesse Hall, who voice similar concerns. Despite establishment claims that there was no widespread election fraud in the 2020.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the-right-seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Bullets are not shot at us from the barrels of guns.
Poisons are shot into us from the barrels of syringes.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, we are back. We're joined by Dr. Piers Robinson, and we're discussing Propaganda in Focus, which you can find at propagandainfocus.com. They have a really amazing team over there, really just taking a look at propaganda, the way that it's used, and a hopeful attempt to educate people so that we can recognize what's happening around us. And I love that you're going to start including people who are not necessarily, you know, experts, credentialed experts, you know, people of academia, because, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. I think some of the best work being done combating narrative management and propaganda is being done by a lot of independent journalists. And it's, you know, it's good to see. And I think that that's why we're seeing the kind of crackdown on independent media and the way that they're really targeting, you know, members of indie media and attempt to shut them up. And I think that the economic stuff is really where they think that they're going to get it done, because a lot of people, you know, once you get to a certain point in independent media, it becomes your income. It becomes your way of living. And then if they come at you and attack you for that, I think it's caused a lot of self-censorship for sure. I think a lot of people are afraid to cover certain topics because they don't want to lose their platform, which is really unfortunate. But yes, that's what we're seeing. It's, you know, it is what it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're forced into that corner, aren't you?
Yes.
When they're acting like that. I mean, you know, it's very depressing that you know we've reached that point in terms of what's being done to independent media. And it's also, you know, going back to a point you made just before that it's very depressing to see a lot of academics becoming involved in these kind of, you know, questionable mapping and networking analysis, where they try to, you know, paint the picture of the links and suggest, you know, you've got a network here of, you know, loosely linked back to Russia and China or whatever. And actually, these academics are operating in the service of power, because, you know, that kind of work is being used in order to, you know, smear and to suppress and to intimidate people asking questions. It's a kind of research which makes no sense. You sort of, you know, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? So those
yes.
sort of network maps, they look very sort of impressive and so on. But all they really tell you is that sort of some people are talking to some people, and ideas are moving around, so to speak. And in a way, I mean, the way I like to think about those kind of images, those graphs which are presented, is that actually it's just this is open debate in action, right?
Yeah.
This is what happens when you have a public sphere and you have people arguing and debating. And it's also when they start to say, well, look at this big concentration around this block here. And I think, well, yeah, this is what happens when people start to win the argument.
Yes.
Because more people get persuaded. So what these people are doing, I have no idea. I think some of these academics believe in this kind of stuff, but others probably know full well that they're just serving up what governments and organizations such as the Atlantic Alliance want.
Yes.
And using it to just you know, basically be able to paint a picture and to paint people as being propagandists for some foreign power. But the numbers of academics, they get seduced by the funding, I think, you know, the funding trains. They also get seduced by the proximity to power. And I actually had this experience. And when I was a younger academic, I used to be invited out to NATO Defence College in Rome. And, you know, you'd go and lecture sort of a big sort of auditorium of officers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's incredibly, you know, it's very seductive in the sense you sort of, why are you getting into those situations and you're getting into that advisory role and so on. And I think a lot of academics fall for that, and they don't, well, I did at one point, and that was just to step back and think, okay, we need to be careful here, that I'm not going to get just caught into, you know, really working for a particular actor, etc. But a lot of academics, I think they see a combination of the money, but also the potential for influence, and then just get seduced into working effectively for governments, in support of governments.
Yes.
And the, you know, you lose your academic independence, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong in a way with you know, and I've done this, you know, talking, giving lectures in various settings. I've lectured anti-war movements. I've lectured, you know, at NATO, as I said, in other sort of official settings. Nothing wrong with doing that. But you have to, you know, always be cautious or careful that you're not just going to get at some point sucked into the contrails. And I think this happens a lot in mainstream academia. And we're seeing it so much, I think, in recent years with the kind of funding which is being pumped at the fake news, disinformation, which is, of course, defined as fake news. Disinformation is as in social media or external actors. It's not looking at the biggest source of
right.
manipulated information, which is governments in the West, who are very good at propaganda. And you know, academics just get, you know, so many have got caught up, I think, in that disinformation realm, and doing that kind of work. And it really is it's a disservice to academia, and it's a disservice to the principle of academia, which is, you know, this idea of being independent and challenging power, and so on. And that's so, you know, the system's so far from that now, I think.
Oh, yeah. In
mainstream academia. I'm being kind of polite. I mean, you know, because I do still work with people who are within the system who sometimes get a bit, you know, fidgety if I say it's all completely dysfunctional.
It is pretty completely dysfunctional, though. It is.
Yeah,
I mean, it really is.
Yeah. It is, and I was in it for 20 years. I'm still, you know, I'm still a researcher or an academic or whatever you want to label me as. But, you know, but I was in it, and I can see it now being out of an institution. I can see how constraining it is. And I think in some ways you don't quite realize that until you've stepped outside and you look back at it. And so on. But
there's probably a lot of people too, I mean, I have no idea. I have no firsthand experience of this, but I'm sure there are a lot of people who get into it, you know, obviously with good intentions and, you know, they want to learn and research and teach and all of that stuff. But you're right. I think that the environment is so seductive, and I think that there's a lot of, mental gymnastics and justifications that, you know, oh, well, just because I'm doing this doesn't mean I can't do some good here. And I think that it's kind of across the board as well in mainstream media. I think a lot of people in mainstream media got into it for, you know, probably some decent reasons. I think Chris Hayes is a great example because, I mean, he wrote a book about the corporate capture of media and all of that stuff. And now he is that. But I'm sure that he's able to make some justifications in his head that, you know, rationalizes it. And well, if I weren't here, then I couldn't do any good. And at least now that I'm here, I can talk about Yemen for 4 minutes every 7 years or something. You know what I mean? There's probably a lot of that. I'm sure it's very seductive to have, as you said, it's the money and it's the influence and it's the access to power and it's the, you know, being kind of in the club, if you will. I'm sure that's really enticing.
Yeah, it's all those things. I mean, I think the status is a particular thing, and as with any of the professional classes in academia, is that, you know, you have the title, or you know, you get through the years and you get to your full professorship and so on, and that's such a precious title that you've obtained, and it's so important to your sort of sense of self-identity. That, you know, you're very reluctant to lose it. And this, of course, is what happened to Kees van der Peil, the Dutch political economist. You know, he was asked to apologize for a tweet regarding 9/11 and a particular state, and you know, it was just a tweet. It was it was not anti-Semitic, but this was the kind of charge that was thrown at him. But in the end, he refused to. He said, "I've got nothing to apologize, and I'm not going to apologize for it." And they took away his emeritus professorship. Wow. So you know he was. That's a kind of a rare thing. You know, most academics would be too eager to hold on to it. And I think it's that status thing. But this is why I think, and this is why I hope, with all the work I'm doing with things such as the Organization for a Propaganda Study and working Mark Crispin Miller, is that, you know, we're all talking about creating these spaces outside of formal academia, and Propaganda and Focus is in a way a kind of a start in terms of publishing and pushing out in that direction. But to try and say, actually, you know, we need to create these spaces where you can have genuine open debate and thinking outside of these power structures, which are just so constraining, whether it's the status or whether it's the incentivization through your career, etc. You know, we really need to create spaces, and it's still not clear how that will be achieved and so on, but we need to, because we need to create these spaces where people can think, people can say things. This is this kind of environment we live in today where, well, you can't say that, and you deplatform somebody if they say that, and you can't talk to them because they're on the right, and you can't talk to them because they're on the left, etc. You know, this is anathema to rational debate and dialogue. And so we need to try and think of new sort of communities of knowledge or scholarship, which, you know, and what kind of spaces will work, because as you said, it's looking pretty broke.
Yes.
just as CNN and MSNBC, it's painful to see those, you know, and it's the same with the BBC, it's the same in corporate legacy media in the UK. It's they embarrass themselves, but they don't realize it yet. They will at some point. These things are broke, and we need to create new spaces, I think.
Yes, and that's why I'm glad that we now have Propaganda in Focus. I think this is a really good outlet for, education and just the discussion. Like you said, you can't even have discussions anymore. You're not allowed to ask questions. You're not allowed to debate. You can get canceled for, asking a simple question about something. And that's kind of the environment that we live in. People are afraid. I mean, so many people, I think, are just afraid to speak because they know that they're going to get labeled and they know that they're going to get, trashed on social media just for asking a simple question. So yes, I think that you're absolutely right. We need to create more spaces where that can be done more openly. Okay, so tell everybody where they can find you, where they can find Propaganda and Focus, how they can support all that good stuff.
Well, let's stick with Propaganda and Focus. It's propagandainfocus.com. We've got a Twitter account, can I find it before I run out of time? It's on Facebook as well.
There's a button on the top of the website. For the Twitter.
There's a button on the top of the website. You can subscribe for updates and so on. That's where you can find it.
And the Twitter, I just found it, is at Propaganda Focus. That's what it is. There we go.
At Propaganda Focus. There you go. I should be more organized about these things.
That's all right. We got it. We got it figured out. There is a button at the top right of the screen if you go to propagandainfocus.com. And you can also follow Dr. Robinson at Piers Robinson 1 on the tweeters. Please go support. Please do that. We need truth tellers now more than ever. Dr. Robinson, thank you so much for all of your work. And thank you for coming on the program again. I really appreciate it. And everybody hang tight. We got more coming up right after this, right here on TNT Radio.